Quite frankly, what you've pointed to is the big problem in the craft distilling industry right at the moment, which is a glut.
This project really is sort of a love letter to Australian wine.
We want to bring people back into rum and not scare them off.
A maritime Tassie single malt whisky felt like the right thing for the three of us to do.
In a perfect world, all the best grapes from the best vineyards would go into the hands of the best winemakers. Doesn't always happen that way.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine, and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
Victorian winery Seppelt today is probably best known for its exquisite table wines. I'm talking about St. Peter's Shiraz from its home region of the Grampians, and Chardonnay, Riesling and Pinot Noir from the esteemed Drumborg vineyard in the cooler climes of Henty. Perhaps lesser known to some of us is Seppelt's rich heritage in sparkling wines. In 2022, the company highlighted that pedigree with two new cuvées named in honour of Charles Pirlot, the Frenchman who in 1890 made Australia's first traditional method sparkling wines at Seppelt's Great Western Winery. Pirlot also pioneered one of Australia's most unique wine styles, sparkling Shiraz. Seppelt shows sparkling remains the benchmark for this style today. And Seppelt winemaker Claire Dry argues it deserves to be consumed more broadly than the traditional occasion of Christmas time. In this special episode of Drinks Adventures, produced in partnership with Seppelt, I started by asking Claire about the story behind this unique wine. Later in this interview, you'll find out a bit more about how sparkling Shiraz is made, and we'll explore the new vintage 2012 Show Sparkling, released this year.
Yeah, I mean, sparkling wine in itself is a really difficult thing to make. You need specialised equipment. You need the right varieties, and there's a lot of things that you need to get sparkling wine right. The fantastic thing about the Seppelt sparkling story is that we've been making sparkling wine since the 1890s. So we were the first ones to successfully produce method traditional wines. And a large part of that was driven by the owner of Great Western Vineyards back then. So before it was known as Seppelt, it was known as Great Western Vineyards. And Hans Irvine, he was an entrepreneur, a local businessman, and he really saw the potential of the vineyards there. And he actually brought in a Champenois winemaker named Charles Pirlot from Reims in France. He was working for Pommery. And he really came in and he set up all the capabilities and requirements that you need to make sparkling wine, because prior to that, there was basically zero production of sparkling wine in Australia. The Show Sparkling Shiraz is a good example of, you know, necessity being the mother of all invention. Back in the early days of the Australian wine industry, we didn't have huge plantings of traditional grape varieties like Pinot Noir or Chardonnay. Often they weren't named. People didn't really know what they were. We had a lot of a variety called Ondenk planted in Great Western and Drumborg too, which was, this is actually a Bordeaux white variety that you don't see anymore, but that's where it comes from. It's quite acidic and people thought it was quite suitable for making sparkling wine, but it doesn't have the character and the texture that Pinot Noir and Chardonnay bring to a traditional sparkling method wine. So there was a lot of Ondenk planted and a lot of Shiraz planted, and part of the establishment of Drumborg was to move away from that Ondenk and go more towards a traditional French style. But the sparkling Shiraz, the story behind that was Charles Pirlot back in the 1890s, there was a bit of Pinot around, and the first Show Sparkling Burgundy that he produced was made out of Pinot Noir, but he found it just didn't have the length and the style to be able to make a good sparkling wine. There was a lot of Shiraz planted, so that's why he started putting away and tiraging Shiraz bases. And I guess the rest is history, because he really did establish what is Australia's iconic wine style. It's one that we hang our hat on, I guess, apart from Cabernet Shiraz, but this is really, you know, Australia's wine, sparkling Shiraz. We invented it, and I'm proud to say that Seppelt is the benchmark of that style in Australia.
Yeah, it was once put to me, and actually Cabernet Shiraz, well, Great Australian Red blends, is probably a fourth style that's unique to Australia, but it was once put to me that there are three wine styles that are unique to Australia, and they are Hunter Semillon, Rutherglen Muscat and sparkling Shiraz, that you can't find anything quite like them anywhere else in the world.
And what I'd say to that is that sparkling Shiraz, I mean, Muscat is produced in other areas in the world and Semillon too, but sparkling Shiraz really is something that Australia has, you know, you can't invent a wine style, but you know, it's very unique. There's no other traditional areas around the world that produce it in large scales. So it's, you know, it's got a really great story, and it's so nice to be able to work with the legacy that Charles Pillow created in the 1890s. It's a real treat.
How much consumer interest is there these days in sparkling Shiraz?
I think there's always interest. We've got, especially this time of the year, we're coming up to Christmas and everyone drinks a lot of sparkling Shiraz around Christmas time. I'm trying to get people to think outside the box and come to think of it maybe as Australia's celebration wine. Instead of opening a champagne, let's open a high-end sparkling Shiraz, but I'll keep on that journey. But we've got two different sparkling Shiraz really in our portfolio. We've got our show sparkling Shiraz, which is the original from, it's basically the same iteration of the show sparkling Burgundy that Charles Pillow created. You know, this is a top-end wine. It's about $100 a bottle. It spends 10 years in tirage, so that's where the cost comes in, because to make a really beautiful sparkling Shiraz, you need to do something to address the tannins. And the best way to do that is to just give it time on lees in bottle. And we've found that that 9 to 10 year mark is really where the tannins have polymerized well. We're getting that, it's almost, you know, that cocoa powder texture, and you've got the beautiful, it's still really fresh because it's been on lees. You've got the beautiful fresh mid palate, but there's a lot of texture and depth, and you know, it's amazing what 10 years can do to a Shiraz on tirage. And then we also have our original sparkling Shiraz, which for people who maybe aren't too familiar with the style, can be a great entry point into exploring it, and before you step up into one that's 10 years in tirage, proper MT.
Let's define in tirage for any of my listeners who might not be aware what that means as well.
No problem. So tirage is probably a word you don't hear every day in conversation. It's particularly to do with sparkling wine. So when we make a sparkling wine in the method traditional way or the MT way, we make a base wine. So in terms of making a sparkling Shiraz, I will make the Shiraz the same way that I make St. Peter's. That it always comes from our best blocks. But there are particular parts of some blocks that tend to have a less aggressive tannin profile, which is perfect for when you're making a sparkling wine, because you don't really want to start out with extra tannin that you then have to polymerize out in bottle. So intirage means we've made the base wine about 15 months after that Shiraz has come off the vines. It's been in vat, it's been maturing in oak, just like a normal Shiraz. And then we fill it into a bottle. And this bottle is the same bottle that you will get on the shelf when you buy an MT wine. So we fill the Shiraz into the bottle, we dose it with some yeast and some sugar, and then seal it with a crown seal. And then your secondary fermentation occurs in the bottle to produce the bubbles. The dissolved CO2 stays in the glass bottle under the crown seal, and then it's disgorged at a later date. But the actual time period between the end of the ferment in the bottle and when you disgorge it, which means taking all the lees out, is called your tirage time. For sort of Pinot Chardonnay blends, you might only have 2 to 3 years in tirage, but in sparkling Shiraz, we've certainly found that that 9 to 10 year mark is almost the sweet spot for releasing.
And the new vintage is the 2012, and then I think the previous one was the 2008. Which years do you choose to make it? It must be vintage dependent, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely vintage dependent. And I know winemakers, you know, we say, oh, you know, we only make this in the very best years, but this is really an example of we only make this wine in the very best years, because it is an icon. It's not only an icon for the Seppelt, it's also an icon in Australia. So I feel, I guess, a responsibility to be producing wines that only fit into that mould. So, yeah, we went from 2008 to 2012, and we should have a 2013 as well coming out. That's quite unusual, but if you have a few good vintages in a row, then, yeah, we can really justify putting down that volume. But because you're holding it for 10 years, I guess it's also a financial risk as well. So we manage stock that way. But I try not to think about that as a winemaker. I'm just trying to make the best wine. We've put down a 2022 base, and there's a few other ones in between those years too.
And tell me about the 2012. How does that compare with previous vintages? I think I read that you had recently tasted all back vintages of the show sparkling from the last 60 years or something along those lines.
Yeah, not every vintage, but close to. So I think it's 12 months ago now, knowing that this 2012 was close to being disgorged, I just wanted to get a better idea of the back vintages. And so I invited in Ian McKenzie, who was the winemaker for Seppelt between 1980s, 1990s. He's the one who put sparkling Shiraz back on the map. He had a real passion for sparkling Shiraz, so it was great to have him in. He came up and we had a few other past Sepult winemakers, Emma Wood and Adam Carnaby, Ian Shepherd come in, and we tasted through all the vintages, and it was fascinating for me because you go back to, I think the earliest vintage we tasted was 62. I have tasted a 45 before, but that was not in the same context. But obviously by that stage they're under cork and they've lost all their dissolved CO2, so you're not really getting a pop or any dissolved CO2. But the wine itself, you can see the legacy behind what they've been trying to create back in the 1960s. So it's really fascinating to see that in the glass and see it evolve. You see the style evolve from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. Yeah, always really strong emphasis on fruit depth and tannin polymerization. So that effect of when a wine sits on lees in bottle, in tourage, the yeast lees work in a way that softens the wine and creates texture and depth. 94 was the first one under Crown Seal. And if you ever see a premium sparkling wine, this is for the audience, under Crown Seal, just jump on it, because it might be satisfying to pull a cork out of a bottle, but Crown Seal is something that will really, it's like screw cap, it's going to preserve the integrity of the wine. So being able to compare wines from Crown Seal since the early 90s, I can see that this 2012, like it's almost, the 2008 was got really good, but the 2012 is almost head and shoulders above the 2008. It's just one of those wines that's come together really well. And the thing about sparkling Shiraz is that it is a legacy wine. So back in 2012, we've had several winemakers work on that process. Someone was there for production. I think it was Adam Wadowitz was in production. Then Adam Carnaby is the one who put it in tourage. And then I'm the one who's disgorged it. So you've had three winemakers involved in that wine, and it's beautiful. And I'm very proud of it.
You've just released the 2012 show sparkling. So how recently did you go through the disgorging process?
So that happened in February this year, and that's a really great process. That's where your wine has been fermented in bottle, it's been sitting on its lees in tourage, and then you need to basically, you know, you've got dead yeast cells in your bottle, which you don't want, or the public don't want, and we need to release that, and we also need to sweeten the wine, which is called adding its liqueur, its dosage. So at this point, obviously the yeast have fermented all the sugar that's in the bottle, because sparkling is generally an acidic wine, or in the case of sparkling Shiraz, it's quite tannic. You need sugar to balance that out, and that's called the dosage. So what they do is they get the bottle really, really cold, and they flick the crown seal off. They riddle it first. That's a very important process. I shouldn't neglect to mention that. So basically they need to turn the bottle very, very slowly over a period of time until it's upright, so that all the yeast cells are in the neck of the bottle. And at this point, they get the bottle really, really cold. They take the cap off. This shoots out almost like a plug of yeast lees, just leaving the clean wine behind. And then we add in what's called the liqueur, which is sugar mixed up generally with some old reserve-based wine, or in the sparkling Shiraz, we tend to use new vintage St. Peter's to mix up the sugar. That sweetness is really important in creating balance in the wine, and that's all measured in a you know, very accurate way. And then it's resealed either with a cork and a muselet, which is the cage over the cork, or the crown seal.
And how has the approach to dosage evolved over the vintages, do you think?
I think we're in a period now in Australia, I guess Australian taste, that we're going slightly drier for dosage. I know back in, you know, the 80s and 90s, wines were a lot sweeter than that they are now. Our Salinger, for example, is sitting at around 7 grams a litre dosage, and whereas a few years, maybe 10, 15 years ago, it was more like 9 or 10 grams a litre, which doesn't sound much, but it does have a considerable impact on the palate. The sparkling Shiraz is probably more fascinating. Back in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, so when we did this tasting last year, I actually analysed all the wines too, and those sugars were sitting up around 25 to 30 grams a litre, whereas the 2012 is actually about 19 grams a litre. So it's significantly less. That speaks not only to the evolving style and what people are looking for, but also the quality of that base wine. So it was so good that it didn't need as much sugar.
How do you like to consume the sparkling Shiraz? You know, I think that roast game, it's kind of a classic pairing, but are there any others that you really enjoy?
Yeah, and definitely have it chilled, just for the audience, in case anyone's confused. Sparkling Shiraz should come straight out of the fridge, much like any other normal sparkling wine. My favourite way to consume it's actually with dessert, because the layers of complexity, and I was talking about those cocoa powder tannins that are in the wine, for me the best match is actually a chocolate-based dessert. Might be because I really like chocolate too, but that's, for me, something that pulls out the sweetness of the fruit still on the mid-palate and those tannins. Cheeses are also a really good match, aperitif by itself, but it's got enough bones and enough weight for it to be served with a main meal as well.
And so when you released the new range last year, the Pillow by Seppelt, what existing other sparkling wines did you have under the Seppelt label aside from the Shiraz, which we've talked about?
Yeah, so we've got the sparkling Shiraz, and we've also got Salinger, which was a project that sort of established the 1980s. It's had amazing show success across the decades. What I felt was missing was something that was going to appeal more to a contemporary audience, something just with the packaging and the feel. It's predominantly, it's labelled as Henty, but the fruit's predominantly sourced from Drumborg Vineyard. So we never had a Brut Rosé either. So it was nice to have a rosé in the mix, because I personally enjoy drinking them. So it's nice to make that as well. So for me, it's just sort of differentiating. You know, we've got a really solid legacy and a solid base of people who love drinking Seppelt, but it's how do you bring that to a newer audience and keep things fresh and relevant. So that was my thinking behind that wine.
While I've got you there, you know, you've also had some really, you know, remarkable accolades for some of the table wines that you've made. St. Peter's Shiraz 2021. Is this kind of the first vintage that you've really been involved with pretty much since the beginning? I think you would have joined in 2021, didn't you?
Yeah, so I took over October 2020. So vintage 21 was certainly my first vintage. So the 21 St. Peter's, yeah, that was my first vintage of St. Peter's. And again, I'm a bit of a history buff, so this job's almost perfect for me, because I love exploring all the history and the legacy of the brand. But I'm also very cognizant of how much history comes before me and how many, you know, great winemakers have worked before me. So I pay attention to all my wines, but blending that St. Peter's was a very special process, and I think I got it right that time, so that was good.
I remember you and I spoke on the podcast briefly, I think it was around 2021, and, you know, I think probably the only wine that you would have made from scratch would have been the Riesling, perhaps, and then Now it's sort of like you're putting out a portfolio of wines that you've been involved with from day dot, kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's hard when you step into a brand, because you're out talking about other people's wines all the time, and, you know, it takes a while to work your way in, but I've definitely got a solid portfolio behind me now. And, you know, I love making the Drumborg Riesling, but the Drumborg Chardonnay is one that I've worked really hard on too. We're seeing some really great success in the show circuit with that wine. And I think it comes down to, you can't just walk into a vineyard and know exactly what to do. It takes a few years to get to know the intricacies of that site and the different vintages and what oak you need to use, et cetera. So I'm definitely feeling a lot more comfortable than I did, I guess, with the brand since the last time I spoke to you. And yeah, it's honestly, it's a pleasure and a dream come true to be making these wines.
Well, congratulations on these awesome wines. Really nice to have a chat, and look forward to drinking some sparkling Shiraz this Christmas.
Thanks for having me.
And at other times, of course.
Yeah, of course.